the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation, here's Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Good Friday morning. Now, I know it's not Thanksgiving anymore, but I'm sure you'll be eating leftovers for a couple days. So here's some Friday farm facts based around the holiday. AAA forecast 54.3 million Americans will be traveling 50 miles or more this holiday. So safe travels for those of you that are doing so. Moving on to what's happening in today's show, Brian German is talking with us about managing soil as it can create better growing conditions. And Taylor Hillman is sharing with us a story on hemp production regulations and how they're gearing up for the new year. And I'm starting off the show today with some news of the romaine E. coli outbreak. I'm sure you've heard of it, and here's what we know as of now. First, it was the massive recall of turkey, and now the CDC has released another food product that people shouldn't be eating anytime soon. According to a CNN report, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention sent out a nationwide warning to toss your romaine lettuce as it may be contaminated with E. coli. A total of 32 people in 11 states, including California, Connecticut, Illinois, Massachusetts, Maryland, Michigan, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New York, Ohio, and Wisconsin, have been infected with the outbreak. The CDC recommends anyone to throw it out, even if you haven't gotten sick. Don't order from restaurants either. In a statement provided by the CDC, they said, quote, "This advice includes all types or uses of romaine lettuce, such as whole heads of romaine, hearts of romaine, and bags and boxes of pre-cut lettuce and salad mixes that contain romaine, including baby romaine, spring mix, and Caesar salad." According to the USDA, people of all ages can get sick. However, children under 5, elderly, and people with weakened immune systems are more likely to develop severe illnesses. The CNN report also stated that the outbreak is not related to the outbreak that happened over the summer, and no common grower, supplier, or company has been identified by the CDC yet. Mike Stewart from the Florida Fruit and Vegetable Association talks about the sourcing of the outbreak and how long it might take.
Well, I've given up long ago in trying to forecast how long it takes FDA and CDC to conduct a traceback investigation and to determine the source of some of these outbreaks. In many cases, that never happens. So I don't want to try and even hazard a guess as to how long this might take. Our objective at this point in time is to try and encourage the agencies to limit the advisories to areas that were in production at the time of this outbreak.
Stay with the show as we'll continue to provide you updates on this story. But for now, more agriculture news with Taylor Hillman.
Producers should see value from a national animal traceability program. As AgNet West reported yesterday, Dr. Jack Shear, the Deputy Administrator of USDA Veterinary Services and Chief Veterinary Officer, spoke at the 2018 Strategy Forum on a new animal traceability program. Shear says it should benefit producers.
There's a lot of steps in discussion of value when it comes to ADT. There's the issue of the traceability in the event of disease. That's first and foremost. But the second is, what additional things can the producer add to that tag for management strategies? How can they benefit and get value out of that, having that traceability system and have data of their own for management purposes in regards to traceability for that product and how that will move them forward if they have that traceability system in place before it's being asked by commercial production.
I'm Taylor Hillman for AgNet West Radio Network.
E-commerce has been significantly increasing over the previous couple of years in the retail sector, and it appears that farmers are beginning to look online as well for various crop materials. Earlier this year, Farm Journal conducted a research survey exploring the use of e-commerce in the ag industry. Through the study of nearly 1,000 American farmers, 8% of growers indicated that they had purchased at least some inputs through an online retailer this year. Of the total number of individuals sampled, 13% noted they planned to purchase some of their crop inputs online in 2019. Respondents who did buy online showed a fairly even breakdown in terms of age brackets. 25% were between the ages of 35 and 49, 33% were between 50 and 59, and 29% were between the ages of 60 and 69. Industry experts have noted that one of the biggest challenges to increased agricultural e-commerce activity is the lack of personal connection. Many farmers prefer the service aspect that comes with purchasing through a local dealer. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
This week, there are several events, conferences, and expos geared for the diversity that is California agriculture. First up is the California Dairy Sustainability Summit in Sacramento at the Sacramento Convention Center on November 27th and 28th. This is the first year the expo is taking place, and dairy men and women can showcase as well as learn about sustainable farming practices, business opportunities, technology, and more. For more information, you can always visit www.cadairysummit.com. Also going on during that time is the California Alfalfa and Forage Symposium at the Grand Sierra Resort in Reno, November 27th through the 29th. The event will cover topics ranging from economics to forage quality, pest management, irrigation, and environmental impacts. For more information on this event, visit calhay.org. That's calhay.org. Next up is the Kern County Ag Day on November 28th at the Kern County Fairgrounds, where you can learn all about the state's number one producing county. To catch up on a list of events happening across the state, you can always sign up for our e-newsletter on our website at www.agnetwest.com. This is Farm City News Day by Agnet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to Agnet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now.
Making adjustments in how soil is thought of and managed can yield some significant long-term benefits. Manager of the California Office of the National Center for Appropriate Technology, Rex Dufour, noted his approach when educating farmers on the complexity of soils and how they can be better managed.
When I talk to growers about soils, I talk to them about investing in your soils. You know, all farmers invest in new equipment. They invest in their buildings. So invest in your soils, too. And I put that in the context of it goes beyond applying, you know, NPK fertilizers. Understanding your soil as an ecology and managing it as an ecology is an important idea for farmers to better understand. And once they start understanding that the soils are essentially one of the most complex ecosystems on the planet, and if you manage it as an ecology, your soil will develop better soil moisture holding capacity. It'll develop a better nutrient management. I mean, the organic matter holds a lot of different kinds of nutrients or helps the soil ecology access nutrients to provide to the plants. There's a lot of microbial ecology interaction with the plant roots that we're just finding out about. And the more you manage the soil as an ecology, the better off that ecology can help your plants and maintain your profitability.
I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
Infrastructure for industrial hemp production is on its way. The California Department of Food and Agriculture has officially announced proposed regulations for a new industrial hemp industry in the state that can form at the beginning of 2019. The regulation proposes that registrations last 1 year, separate registration for each county someone wants to grow in, and a $900 application fee. The proposal also states that registrations need to be renewed every year. CDFA has posted the proposed regulation, and there is an open comment period until December 24th. CDFA said once those comments are collected and considered, they will make any adjustments needed and move to finalize the process. At that point, county agricultural commissioners can start accepting applications for commercial production. Industrial hemp is a new opportunity for producers in the state, as it's only allowed now if a producer is working with a research institution. I'm Taylor Hillman for Agnet West Radio Network.
Well, in today's livestock news, it was recently announced that the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Food and Drug Administration had reached an agreement on joint regulation of cell-cultured foods. FDA will manage cell collection, cell banks, and cell growth, with USDA taking over during the cell harvest stage, then overseeing production and labeling of cell-based meat products. National Cattlemen's Beef Association Director of Government Affairs, Danielle Beck, explains what this actually means.
At this point in time, it looks like the regulation or the regulatory framework, we have a lot more certainty than we did, you know, a week ago. If I'm reading between the lines, how I interpret that is that USDA still has primary jurisdiction over lab-grown products. FDA will be involved in the initial stages. They may make some safety determinations, but ultimately, everything that we've been fighting for in order to guarantee an even playing field, you know, that's USDA oversight, and that's what we're getting. USDA and FDA extended their joint comment period. Originally, it was supposed to close on November 26th. It's been extended by 1 month, so the comment period does close on December 26th instead. From there, both agencies will have to review all of the comments that they receive. They may choose to put out proposed rules for public comment, and that may end up with a whole nother comment process and rulemaking. At this point in time, it's still up in the air. I would say, though, that hopefully within the next year, we've at least got the groundwork for a framework to move forward and build out on. You know, I think one thing that I took away from the joint public meeting was that we don't know what we don't know. There'll be some sort of transition from FDA to USDA oversight, and that occurs during the cell harvest stage. You know, one of the things that we've encouraged both agencies to think about is that you wouldn't ever want to collect cells from an animal that would be otherwise condemned from slaughter. And so having that FSIS veterinarian on site to ensure the health and welfare of that animal, that's a really important component. And so, you know, we'll be submitting comments encouraging FDA and USDA to think about some of these things, asking questions that they may not be thinking about. But, you know, we're encouraging all of our members to continue submitting comments, even if this regulatory battle or turf war seems to have subsided, because, you know, we want to maintain that even playing field. And it's important to recognize that that extends beyond just nomenclature and labeling. You know, products that want to purport themselves to be meat, they want to compete for the same market share, they should be held to the same set of food safety standards as well. And so with USDA oversight of the production process, that means that there'll be continuous inspection and FSIS employees on site certifying that those products are safe and free of foodborne pathogens.
Again, that was NCBA's Danielle Beck. To learn more, just go to their website. That's ncba.org. And it will soon be here. The 7th National Grazing Lands Conference will be held in Reno, Nevada, December 2nd through 5th. The theme this year, taking the gamble out of grazing. For more information, go to their website, grazinglands.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West. AgriView with Everett Greiner is next.
If you went to your supermarket and selected a nice T-bone or a ribeye for dinner, and the label told you that the steak was from a cloned animal, what would you do? Well, here's what a recent poll showed. One-third would pay and walk out. One-third would put it back on the counter. The other third, well, they'd have to think about it. Nothing in studies up to now has shown meat nor milk from clone animals to be unhealthy, but they haven't shown it to produce any benefits either. So, let's go back to that one-third that would have to think about it. My guess is if you separated that 33%, did a study just with them, you'd get about the same percentage figures. One-third would, one-third wouldn't, and one-third still wouldn't know what to do. So, you see, until more profound research is done, you're going to have to decide which third you are in. That's AgriView for today. Everett Greiner, AgNet West.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now.
The Rural Economic Development Initiative is in its first year of working to help rural communities help themselves.
This is something that we've launched as part of the Rural Development Innovation Center, and it really has come just from seeing in travels how important, again, the need for planning is at that community level, and knowing that we have a lot of partners like RCAP, who joins me today, that have that capacity to help us with the communities that need that assistance.
That was Assistant to the Secretary for Rural Development, Ann Hazlett. The group she referred to is the Rural Community Assistance Partnership.
RCAP is a national network of nonprofit organizations that works across the country. We actually have folks in every state, including Puerto Rico.
That was the organization's executive director, Nathan Oley.
We're a partnership in and of ourselves, but we also built a partnership, obviously, with USDA, but also with the National Association of Development Organizations, the Aspen Institute, and 6 regional WealthWorks hubs: the Central Appalachian Network, Communities Unlimited, Community Roots, Region 5 Development Commission, the Rural Community Assistance Corporation, and Rural Development Initiatives.
And what do these hubs do?
Those 6 hubs have been operating a model called WealthWorks, which is really community-driven economic development planning and implementation.
In other words?
And what that means essentially is that they look at the community's assets. They understand not what is not in the community, but what is in the community, and create market-driven opportunities to create a value chain that will allow for everyone from the producers all the way to the consumers to benefit and create wealth in the community that will stay in the community and sustain the community in the long term.
He has one specific example of how this can work.
An organization called Delta Bioenergy down in Arkansas. They created a network of growers, producers, distributors, and local businesses, all focused on creating wealth in their community through a formation of a value chain around camelina oil.
Camelina is a lower cost crop to produce and grows during the winter time.
They have worked to create both that the front end of who is producing this all the way down to the consumers who would actually purchase it, and have created more than 52 jobs in the last 2 years, but have integrated into their own community this value chain through camelina oil to be used in biofuel production. That's created a huge market for them locally, but also throughout their region.
The group's website says it has produced 1,500 gallons of biodiesel since 2014. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
How to find out if you're zoned for backyard chickens. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. You'll need to dig a little deeper in your local zoning laws to see whether you can keep chickens at your place of residence or not. Then you can have a look at any regulations which can have an effect on building chicken housing. Your property will be categorized as either a business, residential, agricultural, or any other. If it's zoned agricultural property, you can raise your chickens without encountering any trouble. Residential or residential slash agriculture slash other type, or if you have leased or rented your home, you'll need to find out further what's allowed. Landlords could have certain requirements other than local ordinances. If you can't figure out the zoning category of your property, go to your city or township hall and have a look at the zoning map. In some places, you can request to get a copy or you can purchase it. And just a fair warning, just because some people in your neighborhood are raising chickens doesn't mean you can too. Go to the right sources, acquire legal information, and then make an informative decision. I'm Kathy Isom for AgNet West.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West. And welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook in under 3 minutes or less from an award-winning chef. I'm your host with the most. Let's get untamed. So our recipe today is going to be a roasted sweet potato. Now, we're going to cheat a little bit. And the reason why we're going to do this is if we put sweet potatoes right in the oven to roast them, it's going to take forever. But I have a really foolproof system of making really, really great sweet potatoes that absolutely are 100% roasted, but also 100% boiled. And I think you're going to love it. Let's get started. So first thing we need to do is we need to clarify, what's the difference between a sweet potato and a yam? Because I know a lot of you are thinking about it right now. And the honest truth is nothing. There's absolutely nothing with the sweet potato and a yam. The only thing that's different is what? The color. So the flavor tastes exactly the same. So if you're ever out there, you say, well, I like only the sweet potatoes that are orange because I like yams. It's really not true at all. The flavor is exactly the same. It's just the color. Now, a lot of times you'll see sweet potatoes on the menu, but you always see them in that bright orange color because everybody wants to say we're using yams, and there's really no such thing, especially here in the United States. Now, potatoes grown all over the world and other continents, it's absolutely 100%, maybe a little bit more of a sweeter taste on the yam, but in all reality, the sweet potato itself has the exact same flavor as an orange sweet potato. So we're just going to call them sweet potatoes. Now, what I'm going to do first is I'm going to get 1 pound of sweet potatoes and I'm going to clean all the skin off of them. Now, I want to make sure that the sweet potatoes have a really good texture to them. So I like to cut these into a large dice. There's a lot of people that say, well, that's not going to taste very good, but I promise you, you could cut right through this thing with a fork. It's almost fork tender when we're done with it. So I take our sweet potato and I remove all the skin. We're going to put this into some cold water. You never start a boil on hot water. Otherwise, you won't fully cook your product all the way through. Once it goes into our cold water, I'm going to turn the heat all the way up, come to a hard boil. Once I come to a hard boil on my sweet potatoes, I'm going to reduce it down to a simmer. You put it to a simmer. We're going to let it simmer for 15 minutes with the lid on. I'm going to remove that and I'm going to shock it immediately. You have to shock this to stop the cooking process. Once I've shocked it, I've let it sit for 10 minutes. And you don't want to move them around once they're shocking because they're very, very delicate and they'll fall apart. We don't want that to happen. Carefully remove them and we're going to dry them. Next thing we're going to do is we're going to toss them in a little bit of olive oil or a little bit of butter, whatever you want to use. And we're going to use our special spice rub included here with the recipe. Salt, pepper, always to taste, and these are going to go into a 425-degree oven for 10 minutes and enjoy. I'm Albert J. Hernandez, and you can call me the Untamed Chef for AgNet West.
This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation at our website at www.agnetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City Newsday. I'm Danielle Leal. The new agriculture operations that take place from sunset to sunrise regulation may be on the industry pretty soon. We rejoin Taylor Hillman's interview with AgSafe's Amy Wolf about the new regulation.
Amy Wolf, President and CEO of AgSafe.
Amy, I was talking to one of your colleagues the other day about the indoor heat standard. We'll have more on that on AgNet West coming up. But when we were talking, you were saying there's something else coming probably sooner than that we all need to start talking about, right?
Absolutely. So I had the opportunity to connect with Julianne Sum, who we both know is the chief of Cal OSHA. And she reminded me that many moons ago, going back actually to 2014, her team had pulled together an official Cal OSHA advisory committee to help craft language around a standard specific to agricultural operations that work at night. And that advisory committee had actually begun meeting 2012, 2013, and the last time it met was in 14. And then it went away. I mean, we all sort of thought it had gone underground, never to be seen or heard from again. And when she and I reconnected last month, she brought to my attention that, no, it is still in motion. And so the agricultural operations that take place between sunset to sunrise proposed standard is currently in the phase of that process where it gets its fiscal review by the California Department of Finance. And so that's when they take a look at what the potential financial impact would be to those who will be impacted by the standard. And that data gets pulled in with the proposed language, and then that's what gets sent to the Cal OSHA Standards Board for review. And like you know, Taylor, the Standards Board is the entity that's been appointed by the governor, and these are the individuals that are actually responsible for reviewing either new regulations or possible changes to existing regulations. And once they get language and financial review, then they open the process up to the impacted stakeholders yet again. It kind of looks like the advisory committee process 2.0, but this is, quite frankly, in my opinion, where the rubber really meets the road, because there is still an opportunity to have language changed. This is the opportunity for the Standards Board to really hear from those who will be affected by the new regulation about what kind of impact it will have on their business. And ultimately, they will weigh in as to whether or not the language that's presented is the language they want to approve, or, while this doesn't happen very often, whether or not they're even going to approve the standard or not. And so the chief's team tells me that we can expect this language and its finance review at the latest to go to the Standards Board in the first half of 2019, but more likely that the Standards Board will receive it in Q1 of 2019. So this new standard for working at night in agriculture, and again, this is a standard specific to ag, unlike indoor heat that's being written to affect all industries, and we probably aren't going to see that puppy till 2020 or 2021 because of how long that financial review is going to take. This standard is specific to ag operations working at night, and you could see it before the Standards Board as early as January, February, March of next year, but certainly by June of next year, to then potentially be approved and take effect for our 2020 season.
That's the timeline of that, the fact that, you know, even when I researched it after we talked, you can't find anything past 2014. It kind of feels like they've slipped this one under a little bit.
It does. You know, there was genuine, what I would call, good faith effort conversation that was taking place between the stakeholders from 2012 to 2014. You saw all of the representation that we like to see from the agricultural industry: Farm Bureau, Western Growers, Grower Shipper, Ventura County Ag Association, California Association of Wine Grape Growers, and their local partners, Lodi Wine Grape Growers, all those folks, in particular the commodities that are affected by working at night. We were keenly engaged, actively engaged. The safety engineer at Cal OSHA, who had been assigned to this task, had been working very diligently to get financial data from all of the agricultural groups. But as we both know, growers are very leery of providing financial data to a government agency and having an expectation of privacy. And so I think what happened in the process is that because growers weren't willing to pony up costs within their own operations, they moved ahead without us, which is always scary, and have just been chipping away at it. And that's how we find ourselves now almost at the end of the financial review.
It's crazy. So let's talk about there's going to be 7 parts to this. I know you just did a little presentation on this, but there's 7 parts to this standard, it looks like.
Yeah. So the language that's been currently presented, we have 6 confirmed elements and then a 7th element that has been in and out of the language multiple times. And that I project based on our new administration that will be taking over starting in January. If I was a betting girl, I'm guessing that it's going to be added back in and there will be a 7th element. So a couple of things for folks to keep in mind. First and foremost, this now creates a minimum 10-foot candle brightness requirement. So this stuff starts to get a little technical when you consider how light is measured. But in essence, if you thought about a worker, just to use wine grapes, because those folks have been harvesting at night for decades. If you use a worker harvesting wine grapes at night as the center point, what this standard is saying is 360 degrees around him, there has to be 10 feet of light from him outward in a 360 degree circle. So how you will accomplish that, as per usual, Kalosha is not going to tell you, the employer, how to get it done, but they're going to let you get creative and figure it out. But the practical reality is many night operations have been using a combination of workers with personal headlamps, as well as light that's both attached to agricultural equipment and stationary lighting as a combination of providing light that, you know, in our current operations. Now what's going to happen is if a Kalosha enforcement inspector comes out, he's literally going to take a tool to measure the amount of light per worker. And then again, in that 360 radius, as well as the brightness of what that light needs to be. And interestingly enough, we have current standards on the books right now. We have a current illumination standard on the books that speaks to the amount of brightness all industries, it's not an ag-specific standard, but that all industries have to have in order to ensure that folks can see when working at night. This is now changing it up a little bit and saying in ag, you got to have light in that 10-foot, 360-degree parameter around every single worker.
Stay tuned to this show as we'll hear the end of this conversation between Amy and Taylor in Monday's broadcast. This is Farm City Newsday by AgMed West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation at our website at www.agmedwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgMet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now. Now that Thanksgiving has wrapped up, it's officially time to set up for Christmas. And for a North Carolina Christmas tree farmer, supplying a tree for the White House Blue Room has been a dream come true. Gary Crawford has the report.
There's no place out there for graft or greed or...
Part of the classic movie Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And this week, a real Mr. Smith is in Washington. Not a senator, though, but a North Carolina Christmas tree grower, Larry Smith.
My ultimate goal has always been to put a tree in the White House.
And after years of trying to win the National Christmas Tree Contest to earn the right to supply the White House tree... A horse-drawn wagon with a 19-and-a-half-foot tree from Larry's farm was greeted Monday by President Trump and the First Lady. Larry Smith said White House folks made an unusual choice for that tree.
Actually, it hadn't even been sheared the last 2 trees, so it's basically abandoned. It's basically like a Cinderella story. This tree, when it was young, didn't look that good, so I guess in the end, that particular tree gets to go to the big ball.
And so does Jimmy Smith.
Oh, I'm very happy today.
But now, a new goal... Put a Christmas tree on the moon.
There's a golf ball up there, so why not a Fraser fir?
Why not indeed? In Washington, Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Certis made a recent investment in California, building a new production plant in Wasco. AgNet West Taylor Hillman talked with him at October's CAPCA conference on what their goal is for the facility.
Sure, my name is Jeremy Adamson, product manager with Certis USA.
Hey, so we're here at CAPCA. We stopped by and talked to you guys because you guys had a big investment in California. Talk about what it is and where it is.
Yeah, sure. So our plant is actually in Wasco, California.
And we have a product that's manufactured there, and it has been our NEMIX 4.5 product. And we're really excited to add expansion there to not only capacity and the product that we can manufacture, but also with assuring the quality of the product as well. And we're doing that through a vertically integrated process that actually starts from a jointly owned venture in India, which is where the neem seed actually comes from. So it's actually clean, extracted, and processed there, brought over to our Wasco plant, where we have a dedicated line for it. From there, it's formulated and packaged all in-house. What's really cool about that, to make sure we're meeting all the standards that our growers depend on us for, we actually can measure it at every stage, and we can look at the, we can check and make sure everything is up to standard.
That's very cool. So this one facility is going to be producing this one product, right?
Yeah, so to be specific, we have a number of our products that are packaged at the Wasco plant, but for this particular product, for NEMIX, that line is only for the NEMIX 4.5 product.
Very cool. So talk a little bit about the product for people who aren't familiar with NEMIX. Talk about that.
Yeah, so the NEMIX 4.5 product is an azadirachtin product. It's actually applied at the early stages of the young larvae, and it inhibits their ability to molt. So if the insect can't molt, it dies off.
That's very good. And what growers are have been most interested in this? What crops are you seeing this in?
Yeah, so this product is fairly diverse. It's going to be used in tree fruits, potatoes, have great play in potatoes as well, leafy veggies, your fruiting veggies. So again, it's a fairly wide use range. I'd encourage those interested to check our label as well.
That's a good line of crops there, not just one. I mean, and with the diversity out here in California, that probably helps.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's one of the reasons why we've put so much focus in on assuring our manufacturing capability because of that crop diversity, as well as again assuring that the product is always going to be up to the standard that our growers require.
This expansion you mentioned to me before we started recording, this expansion also helps you guys increase how much you can get out there. I mean, this was huge for to get more of that product made, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So our capacity and how much product we can manufacture, I can't quantify that exactly, but anytime you have a dedicated line for one specific product, you'd want and hope that we can meet the quantities that our growers are requiring.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can follow Agnet West on Twitter and Facebook with @AgnetWest. Follow Brian German with @BrianAgnetWest, Danielle Leal with @DLealAgnetWest, and Taylor Hillman with @TheManOfTheHill. This has been Farm City Newsday by Agnet West.